Hello and welcome to Education Technology. Today we are going to be talking about data, specifically about data management in further education, brought to you by Capita and Education Technology Magazine. My name is Paddy Smith. I am the managing editor of Education Technology. And I am joined by Andy Yule, who's an independent data strategist, John Cole, who is Head of Management Information Services at Morley College London, and Rob Clark, Business Development Manager for Capita. So let's kick off with you, Andy. Why should we be taking data more seriously?
There's a real tendency, I think, for us to get a bit blasé about how significant and how rapid the change in data technology has been over the last few decades. We often talk about Moore's Law, the idea of the power of computers doubling every couple of years. If Moore's Law applied to motor cars, my Skoda would travel at five times the speed of light. And it's quite difficult to get your head around just how powerful the technologies, and it's changing the world, it's changing our lives, and there are fundamental changes in terms of how educational establishments operate and interact with their students, their customers, their stakeholders. And I think we are living in an age of ever increasing stakeholder expectation. We often talk about the Amazon model, the idea that you log on and have a very personalized experience, everything is joined up. It offers you buying options based on your previous buying options, and that whole seamless process. And it's how we live our lives nowadays. So, there are huge expectations in terms of students and other stakeholders for us to be using our data and our data technology in a way that gives them a really informed personal experience. The technology allows us to create new value and create different types of value that we've never had before. And so in education, we see things like learning analytics, new types of provision, new types of delivery. And again, the expectations around innovation and delivery are absolutely enormous. And for me, the third big driver, perhaps less exciting, but that the huge efficiencies that this technology should be delivering. And when you think of the desktop, just the amount of data that you can process on a desktop machine in Excel and so on, the idea that we are processing data in greater volumes at greater speed than ever before, and that case for efficiency is always a very strong part of the conversation. So I think there are some really big drivers for change out there.
And if we tighten the focus on everything you've just talked about and talk about further education specifically, mm-hmm. What does that mean for colleges?
So I think we need to think about a type of organisational change, the type of which we've never seen before. I talk a lot around data capabilities and the type of new capabilities that organisations need to succeed and thrive in this new world. The starting point for that is systems and processes, and that's kind of where the conversation often stays. We kind of think of data issues as being issues of systems and the processes that wrap around them, and absolutely that's the heart of it. That's where it changes. But I think there are other layers and very significant layers that need to wrap around and support change. The management and governance of data and information assets is an emerging theme. I often draw the comparison with how organizations manage and govern their data assets with how they manage and govern their financial assets, for example. In any organization, finance money will be managed by financial professionals. They have financial professional qualifications. They'll be members of a professional body. And we kind of respect money. I give my children pocket money, and I'm kind of teaching them about, you know, you can buy a comic or you can save it or buy some sweets or whatever. And this really deeply ingrained with us with money. We've had money for 7,000 years, so it's a really deeply ingrained part of our culture and society. But we're not kind of there with data yet. The final layer, I think, in terms of the key capabilities is strategy. So the assertion that data is an asset, something we often hear, and I've often heard, you know, very senior people in organisations stand up and say data is an asset. I've no idea what that means, but data is an asset. And so there is something about, you know, what does that mean for the organisation? And again, you can draw the comparisons with other key strategic assets like money, like people, like buildings. You know, you will have a financial strategy. Your organisation will have an HR strategy. It will probably have an estate strategy. And all of these sub-strategies set out how that asset is going to help the organisation meet its broader strategic goals. Still, in an educational setting, I see very few colleges and universities that have a data strategy, and I think that is a really big omission.
And where do people come into this?
Yeah, so you know we are in the people business. And you know we mustn't lose sight of the fact that actually at the end of the day, organisations, I talk a lot about organisations, but organisations are just collections of people coming together. So at the heart of this issue and the way we respond to this issue, we have to put people at the very centre of this. And I think there are two key dimensions to this. The first is the conversation around skills. And I often refer to a piece of work that the National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts, NESTA, did in 2015, where they looked at the demand for data skills across the UK economy. This was not just about education, this was across the economy. And they found, perhaps not surprisingly, organisations that have a greater emphasis on data skills and recognise and a clearer understanding of what data skills are, perform better by whatever measure of organisational performance you choose. And they did some research and analysis to boil it down to four key attributes of skills that need to come together to succeed in a data-driven environment. And there are skills around an understanding of the business and the domain that you're operating in. There are technical skills around systems and software. There are technical skills around data and analysis. And the fourth one is skills around communications and stakeholder engagement. And it is often the case that data specialists, maybe because of the type of people who work with data and like that kind of thing, is that fourth skill where they're often struggling, finding it most difficult. So that's the first thing, the skills of individuals. And I will just observe that as educational establishments, we are both organisations that have a demand for those skills. We are also organisations that are in a position to create and develop and promote those skills in society. The other big people issue, and this is kind of fundamental to everything, is the culture of the organisation. It was the late Peter Drucker, I think, who said that culture eats strategy for breakfast. To management gurus for you, isn't it? But I think there's a lot of truth in that. And so, you know, we talk about having systems and processes and management and governance and strategy and blah, 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 all of that stuff. But actually, if your organisation does not have a culture that is respectful of data and that is confident and comfortable with data and the opportunities of data and the new ways of working, that data enables and sometimes demands. If you don't have that culture, then you know you're going to really struggle to drive value from data. And so a lot of the work that I do with organisations, although we start off talking around processes and systems and strategies, throughout it all, there is always a big conversation about organisation and culture.
Okay, well, let's move on to you, John, and we'll use Morley College London as a sort of case study. Why did you feel the need to take a more commercialised approach to managing the college?
Well, Morley College London is an adult education college, and because of that, we are very dependent on AUB funding. And similar to other providers who receive AAB funding, we've seen that essentially be unchanged for the last 10 years. As a result of that, in real terms, we've actually had less government income coming into the college. For us to be able to sustain our operations and indeed to grow, which is what we're looking to do, we have to look to diversify our income. We've had to look to diversify our income. So our funding over the last 5 years, for instance, has only increased by 2%. But by looking at a more commercialized approach, thinking about how we collect fee income, how we collect loan income, we've been able to increase that by 23%. So what we've established is that now we've got a much higher proportion of our overall income is coming from fee income. It's gone up from 32% to 37% in the last year. What that does mean when we start to think about how that learning is funded, how we are paying for that, it does mean that if we didn't have that increase in fee income, we wouldn't have been able to support as many learners as we do today. In fact, I calculated it would be around about 550 fewer than it was 5 years ago. So I think that's essential, and that is the reason why commercialization for us is important. It's for us to survive as an organization, but for us to be able to carry on delivering to our communities the learning that they seek. Also, we need to think about increasing competition. So there have been a number of significant mergers, particularly in London, where we operate. And by the nature of those colleges being bigger, they've got many more resources now to be able to look to expand their populations of students. And those are potentially students that would have gone to Morley. So, you know, we're in an increasingly competitive environment in terms of other colleges, but we're also really competing with the students themselves in terms of what income they have. So there's disposable income has only increased at very low levels over the last 10 years. Potential students for Morley College are putting that up against other discretionary spends such as gym membership or going on holiday or things like that. So, you know, that's the sort of competition we've got. Then we think about our customers, we think about our potential students, and what do they expect? What do they expect from us? Do they expect us to be able to offer the same sort of service that they would when they go to shop at a supermarket online or if they go to Amazon? And we find increasingly our young adult students, that is definitely what they expect because that's what they've been brought up with the whole of their lives. But actually more and more actually our older adult students are also seeing that, maybe not quite as enthusiastically, but that is the environment they're living their lives in.
Yeah. And how's the college strategy evolved and what methods are you using to monitor progress?
Sure. So I think the way I've described it there, it sounds like that, you know, that maybe we've jumped to that because we followed exactly what the students are demanding from us. And obviously there is an element to that, but there is a clear strategy behind this. So we have a college strategy, but underlying that, there are a number of other frameworks, including our business development framework, which very much focuses on the idea of sort of a 2-year model of 2,600 courses we deliver every year. Each one of those has had thought about the curriculum design. Is it suited for what's required? Have we got the skills to be able to deliver it? How much is it going to cost us? So we need to have a business model behind that to be able to deliver that range of products as it ends up being, if we're talking in a commercialized environment as we are here. The detailed curriculum planning, then where we start to see the real need for data. You know, the idea that we'll be looking at trends in enrollment data, the sort of the pattern of enrollment payers, how many are paying fees, how many are having their fees remitted because they're able to through the funding arrangements, trends in costs. So we're able to make then very detailed decisions about what courses to run and when to run them. We then need to think about how much are we going to charge for our courses. So we do have a framework, a rate card, where there is a different rate per hour depending on the nature of the course. But we've realized over the last couple of years we need to be a bit more flexible on that, and we've done some analysis and we've started to look at price sensitivity, and we've looked at certain courses that we can see based on the evidence that we've got from our own data that if we were to raise the price of that course, it wouldn't have an effect on the demand and we could continue to enroll those students. If we look at another course, if we were to raise the price, we might actually end up losing the enrollments. We might not be able to run that course. So we are adapting our pricing model to fit that data. So it's a data-led model in terms of pricing strategy. In terms of reviewing and monitoring that progress, we use a range of course sales meetings, course sales reporting elements, where we are looking at the balance between new and existing students, which courses are underperforming against target, so that we can then channel our marketing effort by using various sales techniques. We could use promotional discounts, making better use of our partners to try and promote those courses. So we're maximizing the number of courses that we run that we'd originally planned to run. All of that feeds into our key performance indicators and key performance indicators that we would use on a termly and yearly basis. And that then completes the circle, comes back into the business development framework and moves on to the next year.
It's fascinating stuff. I mean, there's almost some real-time supply and demand in there. And you mentioned, you know, your incentives is almost, I suppose, like a buy one, get one free. And, yes, and again, yep. Very much... calls back to the sort of the new retail model, and Amazon has come up a couple of times.
We'd be lying if we don't mention that. You know, that is the sort of thing. I don't think we aspire to being Amazon in terms of the delivery of education. So we're very much separating that out from what happens in the classroom. This is about how do we get students into those classes in the first place.
And how are you using your data insights to grow the income of the college and to support your learners better?
Well, I think for us to be able to really use those data insights, we need to have good systems in place. And one of those system developments that we worked on for a number of years are our online enrollment systems. So we've now got a large proportion of our learners who are enrolling online. Because they are enrolling online, we can then make better use of sort of dynamic data to offer a better experience to them when they are enrolling, and to try and make that a little bit more personalized. We'll come on to where we're going to go into the future with that. And an example of that is you mentioned there about the sort of promotions, targeted promotions. And we have got some promotions at the moment, which are what we call our multi-buy promotions. So literally if someone, we run a number of short courses, if someone puts three courses into their basket and they fit the scope of the promotion we're running, then we can provide a discount. If they put three courses which don't meet that scope, or they only put two courses, the software is able to dynamically respond to that data and to offer or not offer the promotion accordingly. Equally, we can have promotions which are targeted on the courses which are currently underperforming for the college. They aren't meeting the target, and that will change minute by minute, hour by hour, depending on how those courses are performing. So the courses in scope will change. So we could only do that by having the online enrollment system and making use of good data.
Almost like an Uber multiplier.
Indeed. Yeah, you may use that one. Thank you. Next one I wanted to talk about was about managing customer journeys. So we are very fortunate in the college in that we have about 50% of our learners who come back each year to do another course with us. And that does mean that we can treat them in a slightly different way in terms of their customer journey than a new student. So we can think about, for an existing student, streamlining their experience of how they enroll on their next course, because we don't need to worry so much about initial assessment. We've already got a lot of their data. So we can offer them a much more streamlined approach. Whereas if we were thinking about a new student, we might want to take them through the full inquiry application enrollment mm-hmm. process. But we can acknowledge that at the point of when someone registers with us, what is going to be the appropriate journey for that student.
Okay, what's next? What's on the horizon for Morley College London in the world of data and systems?
Okay, well, there are a lot of exciting opportunities out there for all colleges, I think, and I'm interested to see if we've got any questions on this in terms of the use of new technology. But for us, we are building further on that sort of commercialized e-commerce model. So we've got a new website in development, and as part of that website, it will really be trying to put e-commerce at the heart of how that website operates. And I am going to mention the Amazon word again there. You know, we have thought about that. We want students to be able to go onto our website And if they are a new student, we want us, after we've collected just a small amount of information, for us to be able to suggest courses to them that might be of interest to them based on other similar students. If it's an existing student, clearly we have some more information about them and their journey, and we can start suggesting progression opportunities. Or as we like to think of it at Morley, we've got a vertical progression which might be moving through the levels, but maybe a lateral progression. So if you've done a course within printmaking, perhaps you might want to think about ceramics. So we can start to suggest those sort of courses. So we'll be very much working on that. Linked to that is the idea of making better use of CRM type systems. So that could be within our own MIS system or by linking that to a separate CRM system, so that we can not only think about that student and how they interact with our website, but every time there's any interaction with that student, be that in the classroom, at the reception, if they phone in on the website, the idea of sort of omni-channel approach, that we can offer a consistent experience, because we know at every point their engagement with the learner, as long as they're prepared to share that with us, of course, which is an important conversation that we need to have. We're working with JISC on what they call their intelligent campus thread. And so the way we're looking at that, so this is making use of Internet of Things, and we're going to have a range of sensors in both classrooms and offices. So we're looking at staff and students here, and we'll be monitoring data on movements, humidity, temperature, etc. And then in real time, tying that in with room use data, enrollments, and other student satisfaction, for instance. So the idea is then, by looking at this wealth of data and cross-matching it, can we start to think about how we can improve the student experience by making use of that data, rather than just data that's come from an enrollment form, which is primarily where most of our data is at the moment. The last one I put on there is AI. We are not really doing much work in that at the moment, but we're interested in it. It's definitely something we're starting to look at the research into, and I'm aware there are other colleges out there. Bolton College is one that I've read a GIST piece on at the moment. They're making some initial use of AI, and again, it'd be great to hear some questions from others to see if that's something that they are looking at or they are interested in.
I think it's a fascinating area, and certainly, you know, everyone seems to be looking to the next big thing in buzzword bingo. I'm pretty sure AI is in every time.
Indeed.
Along with disruption, Internet of Things is already gone. So if you are playing at home. Rob, let's move on to you. How do you see the further education data landscape changing over the next few years?
Okay, thank you. So, three main areas. Increasing data demands, I think, is the first one. That's going to be driven by the continued diversification of funding streams, other requirements such as Careers England, we've got the unique learning number that we have to return, student loans, the growth of HE provision in further education colleges as well. And then, of course, we've got the adult education budget devolution that John's already well aware of. How are they going to allocate the funding? We don't know. Is it going to be the same as the IR? Is it going to be separate? Is it going to put more data demands on the end user? We don't know yet. I think we're also going to see, and I hope this isn't too contentious, more of the college's data is going to be challenged for its authenticity and for whether that data has been verified. And the reason for that is the recent increase in alleged fraud, alleged mismanagement that's gone on. It's been in all of the press recently. And I think that's only going to drive people to look at the underlying data, to a sense of mistrust. So they're going to look at the data and say, is that data correct? Is that accurate? Why is that accurate? Have you got an audit trail? Do you know what value that data in that field said this time last year? Who changed it? When did they change it? Why did they change it? Because small changes can have a big impact on things such as funding. My view in terms of increase in data demands kind of goes against what the DfE and ESFA are saying, because an event that's shortly upcoming, they're going to be talking about simplification of the ILR. Now, whenever in my 20 years, whenever I've heard about simplification of the ILR, that means simplification for one or two people and complication for everybody else. It simply doesn't work. And the most interesting point, and bear in mind this event hasn't been held yet, so I don't have all the full details, is they're going to be talking about pre-population and real-time reporting.
Now, can I stop you for a second there? because real-time reporting means different things to different people. So if I let Andy interject, talk to us about real-time reporting. What is it? How should we define it? And why is it important that we define it?
Right. It is really important that we define the term real-time. In 30 years as a data nerd, and I've become utter pedant about some of the language around this. But real-time reporting is such a contentious issue. So there are two broadly accepted definitions of the term real-time, and they are significantly different. The definition of the term real-time, which is used normally in normal English language, is the idea that data is instant. So real-time is about it being very, very fast. The sort of computer science definition of real-time is something about data that processes in a speed that is fast enough to have an effect on its operating environment. And if you are looking at something like an annual funding process, if you are looking at a course that lasts, that runs on an annual cycle, then arguably real-time data is data that is fast enough to have an effect on that annual operating cycle. So there are two ways of looking at real-time in terms of FE data. You can look at the ILR, which is currently collected a number of times a year to support an annual funding process. According to one definition of real-time, that is already real-time data. The other definition is about instant. It's about, you know, the government going in and grabbing transactions as they happen straight out of your system. That is the other extreme of real-time. And if we're going to have a conversation about real-time, we need to be really clear about what the phrase means.
And we look forward to finding that out as well.
There will be real concerns in the sector of other MIS managers if real-time doesn't mean, as Andy describes it, it is about some sort of a dynamic data feed, because just the nature of that data, how we collect that, and the fact that how that could be used by a funding body, that is, you know, we've got to get that right.
Yeah.
So that'd be interesting to hear. Mm.
Rob, back to you, and sorry to interject.
No problem.
I think it was important to get these definitions sorted out so that we don't have people out there with different conceptions of what you're talking about. So you were talking about real-time data, and I think our understanding here is that that is something that is within, say, an academic year or a funding period at a time when that data can still be useful to an ongoing process.
That's right, and it needs clarification if that's not the case, and we'll obviously receive that shortly, so we're very much looking forward to that. I guess the second way in which the FE data landscape is going to change, I think we can't not bear any attention to the fourth industrial revolution. You've got robotics, you've got artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, quantum computing, Internet of Things. We're going to have intelligent campuses. All of these things are here and there now. They're already used, as Andy said, in the banking sector in terms of artificial intelligence. In fact, I believe you can now go online, apply for a mortgage, go through the entire process, upload your documents, and the decision and the money is made there and then, all online, without any signatures. So that's one thing to bear in mind, but that all needs to be supported. So you've got your capital expenditure piece. Colleges traditionally wouldn't have a lot of capital expenditures. How are they going to be able to invest in this technology? John's at Morley College London doing some work with JISC, but is the private sector going to get involved with the supply of some of that? And if you're improving the level of service to the learners as well through things such as chatbots, should you be able to enroll via social media, you're potentially driving some of the low-income jobs that colleges traditionally provide to the local communities out of the college. Are there going to be less people walking around the college, less administrative staff? How is that? What effect is that going to have on the learners as they come through to the college? Final point here is I believe there'll be a shift in skills demands. So however you classify them, data scientists, I think we're going to see a shift where skills within the sector have largely been learnt on the job because it's such a specialised niche sector. You're going to get people joining potentially who've just recently graduated. They've learnt formally what data science is, but how will they fit in? How will they communicate? Will they know how to go and speak to a tutor or an academic member of staff in that classroom who's delivering pottery to a group of 25-year-old, 30-year-old, 40-year-old students on a Wednesday night every other week. May well be able to, but as Andy said, it's down to organisational change and how people look at their data. Finally, I want to back that up. ESFA have just put out a notice for recruitment to some data scientists. So they're jumping on the data scientist stroke digital transformation bandwagon. £15.9 million they're spending that over 2 years, over the next 2 years. That, I think that is an absolutely huge amount that they're going to be spending. What impact is that going to have on all of our colleges? Secondly, as well, with their transformation program, they've already signed an agreement, £2.5 million with Parity to help them transform as well. So if the ESFA, the statutory body, are transforming, they're going to want all of their colleges to transform as well. So that is how I see the FE data landscape changing.
So you let slip earlier, Rob, that you've been working in further education for 20 years.
Yes, afraid so.
How far away is that landscape you've just described from when you first started working in the sector?
Oh, it's absolutely immeasurable. It's akin to the first mobile phone that we all had compared to the mobile phone that we have today. You know, there's more processing power in phones today than put man on the moon. It's absolutely chalk and cheese. Even 15 years ago, the focus was very much on statutory returns to get your funding in. You know, when it came to funding week, funding months, the doors were locked, the blinds were pulled down, nobody from MIS was allowed out until that return had gone in.
Some would like to return to that, I think.
Well, woe betide anyone who went into the system and changed one little bit of data during that time, because it would mean all the checks would have to go through again. So that's changed, and arguably 15 years ago, that was to the detriment of the learner. But now what we're seeing is the focus on the learner. Colleges, as a supplier, have to delight their students. They have to help them to improve their outcomes. They have to be better off after they've been to the college than before. What have they gained from that? How do you measure that? You measure that using data. But some of it can be subjective, some of it can be objective as well. So that's changed. And the way the data's evolved, the services are on offer. There's no online enrollment 15 years ago. The support that's on offer, there's very little pastoral support 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And that's all on offer, and that's before a student's even looked at what they're going to get out of their learning. So that is, it's all about the learning time. And I think they're very much looking, as John said, even his generation coming through at Morley College London, it's a 24/7, 365 experience now. It's always on, it's instantaneous. Next point around commercialization. There's been a big change in commercialization. We've seen the growth of super colleges. Colleges are tending to operate more commercially aware, but we've seen, again, recent stories of colleges who have had issues with funding, issues with their finance, and under the insolvency regime, it's only a matter of time before a college is allowed to go bust. Whether that's to put a stake in the ground, we don't know. Whether they'll be bailed out at the last moment because it'd be seen as politically incomprehensible, we don't know. But I think at some point, someone will. And the final point in terms of how data is involved is it's around use of cloud, deproductization, microservices for everyone who's playing buzzword bingo. I think that's probably another one out there. Mm-hmm. And you've got the growth in massive organizations such as Salesforce with their Lightning platform as well. What can that bring to edutech? Platform as a service and so on. So the days of having a database and DBase4 on a big desktop in the corner of an office that's overheating when the summer because there's no air conditioning are now gone. That was 15, 20 years ago. In terms of where we're looking at now, it's platform as a service, microservices, and that's very much where we're going to be heading.
Great. Thank you very much. Well, I think now it's time to have a look at questions from our audience. The first question I have in is from Louise Jones, who's Director of Information and Data Services at York College. She would like to debate the process of online enrolment and the removal of wet signatures. Now, at York College, she says they are hoping to introduce online enrolment for the academic year 2019-20 for 90% of their adult courses. That's pretty ambitious, I think. So she's interested to know what other colleges are doing. John, what's
so, over to you again,
like
John.
For me, doesn't it? Hello, Louise. I mean, 90% of courses is going to be a challenge. If it was 90% of your enrolments, I'd be very impressed, and I might come and pay you a visit. But I mean, I think this is something that we battle with. We've now been dealing with online enrolments for 10 years. Only in the last couple of years has there been any suggestion in the funding guidance that we could take an online enrolment and perhaps not need a wet signature, but it's not definitive. We're slightly risk adverse in this area. So we have, even though we've taken those online enrolments, when the student comes in for their first class, we are still taking signatures and we are keeping that as audit evidence should it be required. Mm-hmm. But last year we were randomly selected for randomly selected for the external funding audit, and a number of our online enrolments were included in our sample, and that was not evidence that we needed to show. I wasn't able to get that into our audit report, so it's not something that we can use as a precedent, I don't think, but I think it shows that there is a trend towards that wet signature no longer being the definitive piece of evidence that is required for learner existence, as long as we've got other supporting data. So clearly we have to show how our online systems work, show our records and evidence of payment that the student was attending, and we had attendance data, but there was not necessarily a need for a wet signature.
So the barriers are coming down, but we're not quite there yet. Louise has asked another question, but I'm going to skip over it for now and we'll come back to it if there's time at the end. The next question is from Craig Dodson at Wilberforce Sixth Form College. He says it might be worth covering live data versus data warehousing. And year-on-year changes can make data comparisons difficult if the data is required live. While users may want live data, in many cases, a warehouse solution can provide better insights, particularly with the new analytics such as Power BI. Andy, this has got your name written all over it, hasn't it?
It probably has. So, I mean, it partly goes back to that conversation about real time versus timely. And it is certainly the case that, you know, as the technology becomes more powerful, Power BI or whatever technology it is, you know, we are able to process and analyze larger volumes of data more quickly than ever before. And so there is certainly something about analysis becoming more timely. There is, I think, a difference between driving analysis from live transactional systems, as opposed to some kind of managed analysis environment, which will often go under the label of a data warehouse, although data warehouse is one of those labels that can stretch in all sorts of directions.
Needs a definition.
So, you know, there is another one for a pedantic definition on another occasion, I'm sure. However, a couple of key points. I mean, first, I don't think there was a single right answer. I think there was something about looking for the answer that is most appropriate to the given use case that you are trying to address. The other thing I would say, and certainly something that I see in a lot of organisations, is when we talk about management and governance of data, people often think about, you know, data definitions, data access, data control, and the ability to change data and so on. There is also something about management and governance around analysis and the definitions and algorithms used for analysis. And all too often we see organizations where people come together in meetings, each with their own analysis, and instead of arguing about what the data says, they argue about whose analysis is right or not. And so whatever your approach to analysis is, there is something I think that's really important about having clear governance around the algorithms and definitions that you are using, because the world changes and the world is fluid and is continuing changing. Therefore, the data changes to reflect that. If we are going to do anything that is robust and stands up over time, we need to actually have more control over the algorithms that we're using.
Great, thank you very much. The next question we've got, it's sort of online enrollments again, but also Rob might touch on some of the stuff you were talking about with fraud, I think. The question is, how do you ensure audit requirements are met when using online enrollments for funded courses? For example, identification of students, secure electronic signatures, etc.
So certainly when we're designing our online enrollment processes, you know, we're the start point is the funding guidance. We are making sure that wherever possible that we are verifying data as it's collected. So for instance, on address verification, we're using software tools there to make sure we're getting the right information. Looking at the validity of that information by using lookups. But certainly we get to a certain point and we might not be able to collect all of that information in our current environments that we need. So if it is a student enrolling on a course and potentially they are eligible for fee remission, we might not, as in our current system, be able to collect the evidence that is required of whether they're on benefits, for instance. So we've got two ways of going on that. We can either ask for the student to self-certify what their situation is, and then we have subsequent checks, but that then ends up with a two-stage model. Or we think in the future, as we look to develop our website, is there something where we can think more about scanning technology, the ability to upload documentary evidence, to be able to refer to a third-party system, which maybe is secure, that sort of thing.
When you say third-party, I mean, this is like you were talking about mortgage applications earlier, but, sort of going to a credit agency and checking that the person hasn't already defaulted on seven other mortgages.
It's perhaps more conceptual at the moment, but you can see that that could work in a similar way. If there was a trusted source of data that was also trusted by the funding body that we could use in some way to put a check against.
And I think our final question is, you mentioned Bolton College and their use of virtual assistant / chatbot. How do you see the FE industry using this sort of technology for competitive advantage and student experience?
We're looking at it. I mean, as I say, more interested in the concept and the technologies out there rather than specific examples of how we use it. But using the example that you suggested there, I mean, you can see that could definitely improve the student experience if you're thinking about colleges being available for students 365, 24 hours a day, because that's the sort of service we'd never be able to provide at those, in those sort of unsociable hours. Whether that's as good as the experience that they could get at the moment, that's the sort of debate that we have to have. So that's from a learner's perspective.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you could say something like, you know, hey Siri, I need a new student ID card. And then that goes away into a queue, all the ID cards are printed out at once, and then Siri responds, now ready for collection. That's going to save some time whilst for college staff, whilst increasing the level of service. If you say something like, hey Siri, I need to book an appointment with my tutor to discuss my progress. It's much easier to say that and then for the chatbot to go away, look at when the student's available, look at when the member of staff's available, say, well, we can meet at this time, or this time. And you're going to be able to optimise the time of the academic staff, as well as increase that level of service to the learner. So I think there's a lot that can actually be learned through automation. But at the same time, there still needs to be that element of the human interaction. Because, you know, teaching is traditionally, it is somebody teaching to somebody, whether that's online, whether that's in the classroom, or whether that's guided electronically through something somebody's put together. So I think you need to maintain that. But if you can cut back on some of this administrative overhead of manual tasks, of trying to find that time slot when everyone's free, I think you're going to be competitive and you can get ahead in the game.
Can I just add something to that? I think there's a big cultural issue around this as well. And, you know, many people, I'm sure many in the virtual room today, have had really depressing experiences with these online call handling systems.
Yes.
And, you know, there is just something about if we're going to start to use that technology, we have to do it really, really well. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we are going to really alienate the human being element of this.
No, you're absolutely right. Some of the smaller startups have got it absolutely nailed on. Mm-hmm. Some of the larger organisations certainly have.
Great. Thank you so much. Once again, I would like to thank our guests. They were data specialist Andy Yule, John Cole from Morley College London, and Rob Clark of Capita. I've been Paddy Smith from Education Technology. Thank you.
Thank you.